The Middle Ages, Part 3, the fifth talk in a series entitled Church History, was presented by Peter Boringa on May 1, 2007 at McKenzie Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We are finishing the Middle Ages, the section on the Middle Ages that we were talking about for the last 2 weeks. And then we're going to be talking about the period of time, the historical period that's known as the Renaissance, but I'm referring to it for our purposes as the dawn of the Reformation, that period of time where there were tons of things happening that paved the way for the Reformation, which is what we're, I had thought we might get started on the Reformation, and in a sense we will be, because we'll be talking about several movements that really help set the stage for the Reformation, but we're not going to start talking about the Reformation proper until this next week. So let me just wrap up with the section that we were talking about over the last 2 weeks, the Middle Ages. And if you remember, I was talking about different things that were going on in the history of the church, talking about what was going on with the papacy, talking about things like monasticism, what was going on in the civil realm, what was going on between, with regard to church and state matters. We were talking about all those things, and we were sort of going back and forth following those different trends at different times. Well, where we're at right now is right around the 12th century, and just to recap a little bit about what was going on with the papacy. The popes had been gaining power, gaining authority over the couple of hundred years prior to the time that we're talking about this evening. You'll remember we had talked about Gregory the Seventh, Pope Gregory the Seventh, and his battle with Henry, where there was this battle over who had the higher authority. Was it the church that had the higher authority, or was it the state? Was it the emperor that had the higher authority? And this all came to a head. And the papacy reached the point that it had its greatest influence under Innocent III. Innocent III was the very end of the 12th century, start of the 13th century. And Innocent III had his hands in everything that was going on in Europe at this time. He was involved in court intrigue all over Europe. If it was time to crown a new king, he would have his hand in who would be crowned king. He had some influence. I talked to somebody after class yesterday about what went on in England about this time. You'll remember from some of your world history classes when the English nobles forced King John to sign the Magna Carta, and in so doing, they lessened the power and authority of the king in England, and they gained for themselves more power than they had prior to that time. Well, Innocent had his hand in that sort of thing. It was to his benefit to keep some of the kings and rulers around Europe, to keep them in positions where they weren't quite as powerful, weren't quite as influential. Well, Innocent was, at the same time, he was calling crusades. He was involved in everything that was going on in Europe. But at the same time, there were increasing problems of abuse within the church. There was increasing corruption within the church. And we started talking about this a couple weeks ago, back in 312, 325, back when Constantine was the emperor of Rome and when he legalized Christianity. And we talked about the fact that from that point on, there was a battle going on in the church. Once Christianity was legalized, there was an ongoing battle, because when it became accepted, was no longer persecuted, the church very quickly began to acquire power, influence, land holdings, tremendous wealth. And so very soon the church became something that people were willing to fight over simply because of the power and influence that was available for those who had positions of authority in the church. Well, that led to all sorts of problems within the church. Innocent III was willing to consider some reforms within the church, but you got to remember, for the Pope, there was always going to be this problem because the reforms would always run the risk of getting right to the top of the church, and so the Pope was always in a little bit of a precarious situation because he, even if he was willing to see reforms happen, and a lot of popes weren't, a lot of popes resisted that sort of thing, but if the Pope was willing to see reforms, chances are he was willing to see reforms to a certain point, but he didn't want things to get too close to his authority.
Did the Pope have authority over the monastery, or the monastery authority over the Pope?
Pope had authority over everything. And in fact, this is you're getting right to what we're going to talk about here for a little bit. The Pope had the authority to approve or disapprove monastic orders, which is what you were just asking. If the Pope disapproved of monastic orders, he could seize their lands, he could disband their houses, excommunicate folks in monasteries. So the Pope had complete authority over everything that was going on in the church at this point. Well, with some of these reform movements, we're going to talk a little bit now about what are called the mendicant orders, because there are a couple of groups that during this time were trying to reform the church. By the word mendicant refers to the fact that these were monastic orders that gave themselves to poverty, celibacy. And mendicant is the title that they were given because it denotes those who were willing to go around begging for their food, for their livelihood. They didn't have the same sort of massive holdings and the same sort of massive wealth that the other established monastic orders had at this point. Well, we had talked earlier about monasticism. The Benedictine rule had standardized a lot of what went on in monasteries with monasticism. But with all of the greed that had begun to permeate the church, all of the wealth, there was this inclination to try to get rid of those things, to try to disavow that wealth, disavow those huge holdings as a means to try to purify the church, as a means to try to restore some of that New Testament purity. That was always the goal, try to restore some of that New Testament purity. So there were movements that began to take that seriously. A lot of this was going on in the 1100s. And what's interesting is there are three or four movements that I'm going to talk about here for a few minutes. Two of the movements were considered orthodox movements and thus were accepted and embraced by the church. Two of the movements were considered heretical, even to the point of calling for crusades against those movements. And that we had talked about crusades last week as crusades to the Holy Land to try and retake Jerusalem, but Innocent began to perfect the system of using crusades against enemies within Europe and enemies within the church. And we'll see that going on for the next 300-400 years. Well, let me just mention to you four movements real quickly. The Albigensians, they were in southern France in the 12th century, earlier in the 12th century, the mid-1100s. They probably were pretty unorthodox. It's hard to understand exactly what their theology was, but their theology was very similar to the Manichees, and you'll remember Augustine had adopted Manichaeism as his belief system for a while before he became a Christian. So the Albigensians were very dualistic, saw things much more black and white, and thus we're going to have a problem with this whole idea of God becoming a man in order to enter into humanity. That sort of idea would not be something that would go over well with them at all. So The Albigensians were in southern France, and they became hugely popular in southern France to the point that there was some real threat that they would basically take over, if you will, the hearts and minds of the church in that part of Europe. Well, they, after they'd been around for 30, 40, 50 years, Innocent III actually called for a crusade against the Albigensians to southern France. That was when the Spanish Inquisition was initiated. That was another thing that he used to try to purify the church. He used the Inquisition to try to get rid of heresy and heretics during this time. The Albigensians were pretty much, over the next several decades, were pretty much wiped out. In terms of, and I don't mean necessarily all killed, but they, as a movement, the movement pretty much disappeared because of the strong opposition from the church. Well, there was another group in the same area, led by Peter Waldo. They came to be known as the Waldensians. Peter Waldo led a group of itinerant preachers. They embraced poverty. They embraced the celibacy of the clergy. This movement began right around 1176. Innocent III was the very end of the 1100s. So they had been around for a little while before Innocent became the Pope. But again, it was under Innocent that the church rejected the Waldensians, began to persecute the Waldensians, and just a historical note, they persecuted them basically into the Swiss Alps, where they found themselves hidden away, tucked away in some of the valleys in the Swiss Alps, only to reappear 400 years later with the Reformation. So the Waldensians actually embraced enough of the sort of reformed ideals that were going to come up in the 1500s that they found themselves secluded in Switzerland for quite a while, but when the Reformation came along, they were willing to embrace the ideals of the Reformation. And that's a good example of what I mean by some of these movements. I mean, it was right on the edge as to whether they would be accepted as Orthodox or whether they would be rejected. And it was almost as though, I mean, this I'm sure wasn't exactly the case, but it was almost as though it kind of depended on how the Pope felt that day, because there were some movements that were so similar, it was hard to tell the difference between them, and he would accept one, and he would reject another. He rejected the followers of Peter Waldo. Francis of Assisi came along at this time, and we all know at least some of the folklore that surrounds Francis of Assisi. Came from a very wealthy family. He was from the town of Assisi. Very wealthy family, gave it all up, and you hear this repeatedly in the history of the church. Someone who hears the story of the rich young ruler takes that as a personal message to give up all that they have in order to follow Jesus in their minds, in order to preach the gospel. Well, Francis of Assisi was a good example of this. He began preaching and teaching in 1209, right smack dab in the middle of the reign of Innocent. He was another one of those whose parents did everything they could to try to dissuade him, everything they could to try to get him to give up this craziness. But he was another one of those who was known so much for his personal piety, for his personal religious fervor, that people just flocked to him. There were all sorts of people who wanted to be near him, wanted to follow him, wanted to hear more of what he had to say. Well, he was one who went to Innocent personally and asked Innocent to approve. He wanted to basically found a new monastic order, some sort of a formal application and approval process. And Innocent kind of went back and forth for a little while. He was of two minds with regard to what he wanted to do with Francis. Finally ended up approving of Francis, even though there wasn't that much difference between Francis of Assisi and Peter Waldo, but he approved of what Francis was doing. And the Franciscans then, over the next several hundred years, became a major movement within the church, a major movement, a monastic order that was known for its scholarship, just became a major movement within the church. A few years earlier than that, Dominic, in 1203, Dominic likewise was inspired to set about preaching on his own, gave up his position in the world. He actually was inspired by the Albigensians. He was inspired by their devotion, their commitment, how rigorous was their discipline. He was inspired by all those things. Didn't necessarily embrace the same theological positions, but he was inspired by how committed that they were. And he went and appealed to Innocent III to have his movement approved, and Innocent responded with a maybe, a kind of. And what he did, basically, was he said to Dominic, there's nothing wrong with what you're trying to do, there's nothing wrong with your theological positions, but we're getting a few too many monastic orders right now, so why don't you go join this group over here and just become a part of this monastic order, which he did. But over time, his movement, the Dominicans, actually, I mean, basically took over that order, if you will, and later became known as the Dominicans. So he was another one of those who went out preaching, and after having some success and gaining some notoriety preaching and having people follow him around, goes to the Pope, and the Pope encourages him to join another order. Well, the reason I bring those up is because those movements were tremendously appealing to the rank and file in the church in those days. You see, the corruption that was going on within the church, all of the problems that were going on within the church, were not unnoticed by the rank and file, by the people. And you can imagine if you go to Mass on Sunday, and the individual who is celebrating the Mass, in fact, has several illegitimate children, perhaps had bought his position within the church, which were practices that were common in those times, was living openly with a concubine. You can imagine that would be very unsettling to the individuals within the church. And so they liked to see some of these reforming orders, some of these mendicant orders come along, because they wanted to see reform within the church. Because in their minds, they're still trying to make this connection between their own personal salvation, their own personal eternal destiny, and the individual who is charged with teaching them and with ministering to them. And if they see that there is a huge gap in the life of that individual, a huge gap between who they are and the picture of what a minister of the gospel should be, well, it was understandable that they wanted to see some changes within the church. They wanted to see some things loose, or some things cleaned up. So, yes, the pretty woman in the back.
And at that point, does that person that's ministering actually have control over their destiny, whether or not he's going to give them a mass?
Well, not so much that, as much as the church has control over their eternal destiny. That is the sole minister to them of the church at that point. But there's still that question that goes all the way back to the period of persecution in the first couple of hundred years of the church, and that is if the ministering that is going on, or the sacraments that are being offered, if those are being offered by someone who is unworthy, back during the time of the persecution, the question was, had they given up the faith? Well, then, should they be allowed back into ministry if they had become apostate? And was their ministry still valid? That was the question in the first couple hundred years. Well, the same kind of question is there. Is the ministry of this particular individual valid when their life is so out of sync with any sort of understanding of what the gospel would call for? So it wasn't as though, to answer your question real specifically, it wasn't as though that priest would say, "Well, I'm not going to give you communion today." That didn't go on.
But you had received authentic,
the sacraments.
Yeah. Right, and so the question would be, is this authentic?
That would be the question in people's minds. You bet. Yeah, yeah.
It's not like us just having a bad pastor.
No.
Sort
of skip over that. Nope. I mean, for them, there truly was a question of whether or not they're, because the sacraments had to be partaken of in order to be a part of the church, and that was the only way to be saved, was to be a part of the church. Well, if the sacraments are given in an unworthy manner, celebrated in an unworthy manner, there's the question of whether or not they're valid at that point. Okay. So that's a little bit about the mendicant orders. We talked about papal authority, and we'll talk about this a little bit now and a little bit more in the next part of the lecture as well. As I said, Innocent III was, without question, not simply the most powerful pope in the history of the Catholic Church, but at this time, he was the most powerful individual in Europe at this time. Well, that was the high point, if you will, then, of the papacy. That was the point at which the church had the most power, the most prestige, the most authority. And that's the point at which it began to go downhill. For the next 100 years, or for the next 80 to 100 years, the popes, you didn't find popes that had the same status as Innocent did, who carried the same weight that Innocent did, and yet they, riding on his coattails, asserted the same authority that he did. That came to a head at the end of the 14th century, no, at the end of the 13th century, with Boniface VIII. Boniface VIII was a pope who decided to put all of this in concrete by enacting into church law. He issued a bull, and now that's just the technical term for what the pope could issue. It's called a papal bull, which is his statement ex cathedra. And let me tell you what that means. If the pope speaks from his position as the vicar of Christ, as the heir to Peter's role as Bishop of Rome, if the pope speaks in that capacity, that's called speaking ex cathedra. That is from the seat of St. Peter, from the chair of St. Peter. And if he speaks in that way, it is authoritative for the entire church. Now, if he asks, "How's the weather today? Who do you think is going to win the game tonight?" That isn't ex cathedra. But when he pronounces, "This is now church teaching, church dogma, or church doctrine," and he pronounces it from his position of authority within the church, then that's supposed to be binding upon all of the church. Well, and that's what happens when a pope issues a papal bull.
Do they still have the bulls today?
Oh yeah. You will still see in the church today, there are still papal bulls that are issued from time to time. So.
There are a lot of things to dictate.
Oh no, there's still plenty of things to issue dictates on. No question. So Boniface VIII, his reign as pope was from 1294 to 1303. He issued the bull Unum Sanctum, and we're going to talk about that a little bit here in a few minutes in the next lecture. But that papal bull basically was intended to solidify all of the authority, all of the prestige and power and influence that had been part of Innocent's rule as pope. That was meant to set that in stone as part of church dogma and church teaching at that point. Well, the problem was he issued the bull Unum Sanctum somewhere around the early 1300s, but within a very short period of time, everything fell apart or began to fall apart with the papacy. Now, some of the problems that we had talked about before, some of the corruption within the church was still a problem, and thus the authority over all of the church was weakening. People were skeptical of the church, skeptical of the authority of the church. Well, soon after Boniface VIII issued that bull that basically said that the all authority, all power is centered in the church and particularly in the Pope, within a couple of years after that, Pope Boniface was himself kidnapped, so much for his authority, so much for his power, so much for the control that he had over others. He was kidnapped, and soon after that, he died. Well, that began, right after his death, there began what is known in the history of the church, what is known as the Babylonian captivity of the church. Picturesque term. It harkens back to the Old Testament account of the children of Israel being taken into captivity in Babylon. What happened was the kings of France were tired of seeing the papacy in Italy with all of the power and influence in Italy, and so the kings of France basically kidnapped, for lack of any other way to put it, kidnapped the Pope, set up the Pope with a new court in the city of Avignon in France. And for the next almost 70 years, the papacy was no longer in Rome. It was in France. And it was thus under the thumb, completely under the thumb, under the control of the kings of France. So Innocent III is the most powerful man in Europe. And 100 years later, the Pope is a virtual house captive in his own home in Avignon, where the papacy has been taken to serve the purposes of the King of France. Margaret.
I thought that there were two papacies.
Don't get ahead of me now. We'll get to that here in just a minute. Yes, we're getting there. Yes. What did you just say? Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, there wasn't. Don't you? Let's get serious now. Come on.
I wrote that down to ask later. I was going to wait till the end.
So we'll get to your question in a minute. And yes, there was more than one pope. There were several popes during that time. I have no idea where Waldo is, but actually he's in Switzerland by this time. Yes, that's right. Yes.
When they issued those bulletins, did they go away or did they just kind of add up?
You don't. I mean, the only way you get rid of an edict like that is if a subsequent pope changes the teaching of the church and reverses something like that. So once one is in place, that is church law, that is the teaching of the church until it's reversed by either by a pope or by a church council later on. So, rather than keep taking a lot of questions, let me just continue here, and then you can hold your questions for the end for the most part, unless it's really important.
Well, I was wondering if we get our modern saying, oh, that's a bunch of bull, or that.
It might be. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if that's the case or not, but it might be. You never know. Okay. So there's the Babylonian captivity. It began with Pope Clement V. He was elected in 1305. He didn't even visit Rome during his papacy, which was 1305 to 1314. The papacy was in Avignon until 1377. So it was really right at 70 years, thus the term the Babylonian captivity. And the Pope didn't even come to Italy. Well, that caused all sorts of, you can imagine the turmoil that would have caused, because the Pope is the Bishop of Rome. He's not the Bishop of Avignon. He's the Bishop of Rome. His authority comes from being the heir to Peter's role as the Bishop of Rome. So this created all sorts of confusion within the church and further created skepticism on the part of everyone about the church and about the papacy. So you can see during this time the prestige, the authority that the church had begins to diminish little by little, bit by bit, because of some of the things that are going on within the church. Well, on to Margaret's question, in order to resolve this question or this problem of having the Pope in Avignon, the College of Cardinals got together. When one Pope died, they elected a new Pope to take up residence in Rome. But the problem was there was another group of cardinals that named another Pope still in Avignon. That began the period, 30, 40 years, known as the Great Schism. The Great Schism was that time during which there were, in fact, two popes. There was one pope in Avignon that was under the control of the King of France. There was another pope in Italy who was, you can imagine, the papacy was weakened dramatically at this point. The popes did not have the same sort of power that they did before. They were, during this period of time, they were much more pawns than they were church rulers, church authorities. Well, there was the Great Schism where there were two popes that were in residence at different times and involved even in military battles against each other to try to depose each other. And different councils would depose the other pope and excommunicate and anathematize. And I mean, all this was going on during this period of time when there are two popes. Well, we're going to come back to that here in a couple minutes when we start on the next lecture. But let me just mention to you a couple of other things that are going on during this time that contribute to the just the general societal chaos that was going on that was going to help pave the way for the Reformation. And I don't know if you can remember over the last couple of weeks as we've talked about what went on in the empire when the empire in the east and in the west split. Well, for a while, Europe was united primarily under the Pope. Yes, there was a King of France, there was a King of England, there was an Emperor, there were other rulers, but for the most part, Europe was thought of as the body of Christ. Corpus Christianum was the phrase that is used to describe that. And Europe was unified as such. Well, during the 1300s, you begin to see the rise of nationalism, at least in part because the papacy was so weakened, because the church was rightly at this time somewhat in disrepute. And so you began to see different countries who would assert their own authority, who would become much more nationalistic, rather than seeing all of Europe as being united. They would basically assert their own independence as different nations. Well, it was during this time that the Hundred Years' War went on, and I'm not going to go into any detail virtually about that at all, but the Hundred Years' War went on from 1337 to 1476, the Hundred Years' War that was 140 years. It was between France and England, but all of Europe ended up getting involved. There was huge loss of life, tremendous chaos, tremendous upheaval in European society at that time. The Hundred Years' War just wreaked havoc with any sort of order or unity that folks thought that there might be in Europe. I'm not going to go into any details, but the story of Joan of Arc, or the account of Joan of Arc, took place during the Hundred Years' War. There are lots of famous historical incidents that went on during this time. But imagine for 140 years, basically, war ravaging. It wasn't constant. There'd be periods of time that there'd be a lull in the fighting, in the conflict. But it was always there, waiting to boil up again. Well, it was also during this time, 1347, that the plague began. Continued off and on for many, many years, and it's suggested that over the next couple of decades, the plague took the lives of as many as one-third of the entire populace of Europe. Well, that in and of itself had all sorts of implications for changes in society. You would have And it wasn't universal. It wasn't one-third of every part of Europe. There were some parts of Europe that were hit much harder than others. But imagine when you would have entire populations of given areas virtually wiped out. Imagine when you had that sort of upheaval with the system of commerce, with all of society. But imagine also what people were asking of themselves with regard to what is God doing? When they see the Hundred Years' War going on, when they see the plague going on, and when they look at the church and see that the church isn't holding up its end of the bargain in terms of maintaining some form of holiness, some form of righteousness, there's this question about whether or not the church is letting them down and thus opening the door for these sorts of things happening. Well, that brings us to the end of the lectures that I was going to do on the Middle Ages. Now we're going to jump to the next section, which is, yes, Daniel. Well, I can't address it very well, but let me talk about it very, very briefly. I would love to, I wish we had more time to address it further, because much more during the period of the Renaissance, which is the period that we're going to start talking about right now, but even during the 12th century and around that time, there was just some tremendous advances in art and architecture, and it was all connected to the church. It was all tied in with the church. You would see, if you looked at the art, the paintings, the frescoes, that sort of thing of that time, virtually all biblical or religious themes of one sort or another, if not biblical, at least dealing with, you know, with something in the history of the church, the lives of the saints, all that sort of thing. Manuscripts and the artwork that went along with manuscripts, absolutely unbelievable. You'll talk with us at some point here about the music that was going on. What I would have liked to have done would be to have some slides that would show something of the architecture of the period, specifically Gothic architecture. Have any of you had occasion to see examples? There are some in America, not very common, but there are quite a few more in Europe, examples of Gothic architecture, of cathedrals, churches that were built in the Gothic style. Truly, unbelievably amazing. The engineering that went into building the Gothic cathedrals was amazing. The whole concept of flying buttresses on the outside of the church that would allow them to build the Gothic cathedrals were known, and there was actually almost some competition. Sort of like nowadays, it's a question of who's going to build the tallest building in the world. Well, in those days, in the Middle Ages, it was who's going to build the tallest cathedral in the world. And to do that, to get them just to stand up and not fall down, they had to come up with these amazing engineering advances. Flying buttresses was the way they created a structure outside the building that would carry some of the weight of the building, so that they could build them as tall as they did. And if you go into a Gothic cathedral, they are stunning. And the whole impetus with that design, with that type of design, the whole impetus was to create an architectural space. If I'm not careful, I might sound like I know what I'm talking about here, but to create an architectural space that, when you walk in, your eyes are drawn upward. The clear story windows that they had up high would make the interior unbelievably light, as opposed to the Romanesque architecture that had been used prior to that time. But the clear story windows, the stained glass windows, which was in and of itself and just an amazing art, the ability to make stained glass, the materials that were used, that if you go see a cathedral and you look at a window from the outside, it looks like just sort of a dusty, dirty window. You go inside and the light coming through those stained glass windows creates the most unbelievably beautiful scenes. Well, the whole point of Gothic architecture was to, I don't mean to sound kind of weird, but was to elevate the spirit, elevate one's sensibilities. I mean, that was the mentality that they had. That was the reason they built things the way that they did. One thing that I think is really funny is if you go into a Gothic cathedral today, stone walls, I mean, relatively drab stone walls, and we think of them as being sort of cold stone walls. When they were built in the Middle Ages, the entire interior was painted with the most gaudy colors imaginable. I mean, just it was just outlandish colors. The whole thing was just alive with color and with light, and it was sort of a sensory feast, if you will. So that was basically all I was going to say about art and architecture. But if you have the opportunity to pick up a book on Gothic cathedrals, or if you are in Europe, particularly some of the best examples, the Cathedral at Chartres, the Sainte-Chapelle in France, there are several cathedrals and chapels around that are just amazing displays of Gothic architecture, all done with a spiritual purpose. There was a reason why they did the things that they did, the designs that they did, and the construction that they did. So, well, let me pause real quickly for any quick questions before we move on. I've got a lot to cover yet. Oh, yes, we got to hand out the mic. So there's a lot to cover, so okay.
I just have a couple of things. First, were the Anabaptists the same as the Waldensians, or were the Waldensians kind of included in the Anabaptists?
Anabaptists will come later.
Oh.
Tune in again next week.
Excuse me. Now, the cardinals in Avignon, were they French cardinals too?
Yeah, for the most part, that was part of the nationalism that was going on at this time. You would have the Italian cardinals who wanted to have the papacy back in Italy. You would have French cardinals who would be wanting the papacy there. So, yeah, that was part of the struggle.
And I kind of see the plague as kind of a reform movement to kind of get things going, because in many places, peasants could now demand better wages and better rights because there just wasn't enough people around mm-hmm. to do mm-hmm. work.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no question, everything was turned upside down in society, and opportunities were created that weren't there before. So anybody else, any other questions before we move on to the next section?
Just kind of what you were just talking about with the cathedrals. That seems like a really, really far step from the monastic movement and the poverty, the Franciscans. Can you talk about that, just the change that had happened?
The only thing to be said about it is it changed, just
so,
exactly
I mean,
there
that. Was several hundred years between those, and that's just kind of the way the church
You went. Bet. Yeah, that was characteristic of what happened within the church. A movement would begin with certain principles, certain ideals, and within the first generation or two, maybe hold on to those ideals, and then things would change. And so, yes, over time, the Franciscans, the Dominicans, became wealthy, landed orders as well as the other monastic houses. So, yep. Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's see. I noticed in Europe, like, they have a history of, like, building, you know, it's big. Well, like, when the Romans and Greeks and stuff were worshiping, you know, various gods, they build huge temples, mm-hmm. and so I kind of thought maybe this might be a sort of extension on that, you know, except various gods are trying to do the same thing for the one god.
Yeah, there's no question that that's the case, that that there would be the sense that the truly pious, the truly righteous, and this in my mind gets back to just the nature of humanity and the human impulse, the idea within the church that if you were truly righteous, if you were truly pious, you'd do something really big for God. I mean, whether it's build a cathedral, whether it would take some other form. But yeah, there's no question that that a lot of that was motivated by true devotion, and a lot of it was motivated to be bigger and better and to somehow or other make a bigger statement than the other person had. So you have that mix of motivations.
I'm really tempted. Okay. Because that's interesting to follow up on.
Okay, you got to use the microphone then.
When you have the Black Death and you have the Hundred Years' War and you have all of this mayhem going on at the same time, and I think you answered the question just now, why do you have this incredible proliferation of some of the best and the greatest art in all the world? And that goes along with music. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but I think you just answered it. It was towards piety? Is that what they were looking for?
Yeah.
Can you develop
well,
talk
I,
about that?
I don't know how much I can develop it, but certainly within the church then, as well as within the church today, there's always going to be a mixture of motives. And so, yes, there would be some art, some music. I mean, you would find in the Renaissance, you would find artists who would be creating this unbelievable religious art with the most petty of relationships with each other. I mean, fighting, tearing each other down, disparaging each other's work. So there, for some folks, certainly there was a motivation of fame and just basically using one's skill to gain fame and notoriety. But there was also, alongside that, with different people, with different individuals, there was also the impulse of wanting to say something about what's going on in the life of the individual, about the gospel, about who God is, wanting to say something of that in art and in architecture and in music. So you have both those motivations then, as you do today. I mean, that's still true today in the church. Okay, well, let me jump into the dawn of the Reformation. I'm going to try to talk kind of fast because I really would like to get through this today if we can. We've been talking about the Middle Ages. I've given you a lot of that background, and so some of the points here in the first part of this lecture, just a recap. We talked about Boniface VIII. Now, let me tell you specifically what the papal bull, Unum Sanctum, what that meant, what that indicated. The papal bull declared that there is one holy Catholic apostolic church. So it basically is saying, lest there be any question in anyone's mind, there is one church and one church only. There are no movements. There is no legitimate Christian presence outside of the one holy Catholic and apostolic church, according to Boniface VIII. Outside of which, outside of the church, there is no salvation or remission of sins. So again, what had become a part of the tradition of the church, what had become a part of the teaching, is codified with Boniface VIII when he makes it explicit. You will go to hell if you are outside the church. There is no salvation or remission of sins outside of the church. And finally, the Pope is the supreme head of the church. So that was what was contained in Unum Sanctum. Also contained in that was the declaration that the ultimate authority in the world was the spiritual authority, specifically over the temporal authority, going back to the things that had gone on earlier in the history of the church. Well, that's Boniface VIII, dies in 1303. 2 years later, the Babylonian captivity begins. The Great Schism takes place from 1378 to 1417. Some of the problems with church practices, we've alluded to them, talked about them briefly before. We talked about simony. Simony is the practice of buying a church office. Goes back to the account in Acts of Simon, who wanted to buy the Holy Spirit. Well, in the church in the Middle Ages, you could buy a bishopric. You could buy a position as a priest. You could buy an office within the church that would have with it income and perhaps land holdings. By the time you get to the Renaissance, you can buy the papacy if you want to. So simony, the practice of buying church offices, was going on. Pope John the 22nd, while he was in Avignon, he was one of the popes during the Babylonian captivity. He really refined this whole business of simony by setting in place the system whereby when you bought a church office, the first year's revenue from that church office went to the pope. That was known as the annate, from the Latin word annum, for year. The first year's revenues went to the pope. If the seat, if a particular bishopric or something like that was empty, he got to keep all the revenue. That was the reservation, was what that was called. He would keep all the revenue. Or if it looked like a seat was going to become open, there was a bishop that was getting old or was ill or something like that, he could take a deposit on the position within the church. So he had all sorts of ways to be able to make money off of selling church offices. And added to that, he worked out this great system whereby if a position in the church would open up, he would move one bishop from one position or one church leader from one position to another, collect the fees on that, and collect the fees on the vacated position. So he had it all wired so that the practice of simony under Pope John the 22nd just created tremendous income for the pope during that time. That was when they began the practice of selling indulgences. Indulgences in a nutshell, and we'll talk about this more with the Reformation in another week or so. Indulgences was the way that the church was allowed to offer remission of sins, some sort of forgiveness for sins, in exchange for something. It was put in place during the Crusades, when those who went on Crusades were offered indulgences because they were not able to be in their own home, participating in the sacraments, and so indulgences were a reward, if you will, a remission of their sins, since they couldn't have their sins remitted by going to confession, going to Mass, partaking of the sacraments at home. Indulgences were a way for them to have their sins taken care of while they were on the road, while they were away from home. Well, that was during the Crusades. Margaret?
Are you sure about that? Because the later understanding of indulgences, like when I was a young Catholic, was that you could receive forgiveness of your sins by confession, either literally with a priest, or if the priest was not able to be there, by being truly contrite. But that left purification. Your sins were forgiven, but you were still unclean. And that purification, if you died not being purified, was a different thing from being forgiven. You had to go to purgatory for a certain amount of time to be purified, the purgation there. And so an indulgence was lifting some of the time that you would have to spend in purgatory for being purified after you died.
Yeah.
It could be that changed.
Well, there during this time, there was that was one of the great debates in the church, was exactly what did an indulgence do? Was it simply a remission from a temporal perspective of your sins and thus get out of purgatory earlier, have a shorter period of time in purgatory, or was it in fact remission of sins? So that was an ongoing debate. Now we'll see when we get to Luther, in the account of the sale of indulgences that Luther was up against, it was specifically with regard to purgatory. But
so
that
you
was
bought these indulgences?
Well, you see, that's what we're getting to. This is what we're getting to next. When you went on a crusade, the indulgence would be offered to you, basically as an incentive. I mean, what you paid for the indulgence was going on the crusade. But once the system was in place, I mean, once you could work out the whole system of indulgences, yes, in fact, they began to be something that would be sold. They began to be something that was used to raise money for different things. And we'll see this again next week when we talk about what was going on with Luther. Indulgences were a means to get income to the church for all sorts of different projects, including, in some cases, bring in money so that someone could buy the office, buy their church office. Well, the whole idea behind indulgences was the idea that Jesus and the apostles and the saints had stored up so many merits, they were so good that there was this treasury of merits that was, who had the keys to the kingdom? The Pope did. It was at the disposal of the church, the disposal of the Pope, this treasury of merits that could be drawn on to take care of someone else's sins. They had so much good stored up that some of that could be used to offset some of your bad, is the idea. That was the theory behind indulgences. And yes, in fact, they began to be sold, used to pay in some cases. Oh, that's when they began to be sold, was initially they were offered to the Crusaders, and then the Pope got the idea, we can use this to help pay for the Crusade. So if you want to stay home but buy an indulgence, we can use this to help pay for the Crusade. So that's when the transition was made to actually purchasing indulgences. And from there, it spread dramatically. Well, we're still talking about the period of the Babylonian captivity. Before long, the Pope in Avignon, this is in the 1300s, remember, the Pope in Avignon collected three times as much revenue as did the King of France from his holdings, from his land holdings, from his taxes, that sort of thing. So the papacy was unbelievably wealthy, more and more ways to make money at this whole thing. Pluralism was rampant. We're talking about the abuses in the church. Pluralism was rampant. That's the practice of having more than one church office. It was possible to be a bishop here and a bishop there. It was possible to be the abbot of more than one monastery. So it was possible to own more than one church, or more than one church office, kind of like being a businessman who acquires more than one business, and before long has the income from more than one business. That's what's going on with pluralism. Clerical abuses. There was the imposition of celibacy within the church. And when celibacy was imposed on the church, it was insisted that priests and church leaders be celibate. Along with that came into place a system, I mean truly, and I can't explain to you how it all worked out, but a system of concubinage whereby the church officer, the church leaders, the bishops, the priests would have concubines. Everybody knew about them. I mean, everybody understood it. And in fact, the concubines were taxed by the Pope so that there was income for the Pope, even from the priests and the bishops and the cardinals having concubines. That's how crazy it got. Well, no, they would tax the bishop or the priest, but there was a system of taxation that went along with having a concubine.
For having one.
Yes, for having one. Yep. So, basically, just before the Reformation began, the papacy itself had become pretty much just a pawn in the power struggles that were going on in Italy and in Europe. We'll talk about this some more in a little while, that the papacy by the period of the late 1400s was unbelievably corrupt and decadent. I mean, everybody in Europe acknowledged by this point the need for reform. Everybody within the church, everybody outside, there wasn't anybody that was really outside the church, but the need for reform was just very obvious to everybody. Well, back to the Great Schism. The way to try and solve this problem of having more than one pope was the cardinals got together and they decided to elect one pope. So there was a council that was called in Pisa in 1409. The cardinals under both of the existing popes got together independent of those popes, And the cardinals decided, okay, we need to reunite the papacy. So they got together, elected a new pope, deposed both of the other popes. They didn't take the side of one pope or another. They deposed both of the other popes, at which point we had three popes. You guessed it. Because the two popes who were deposed would have none of it. They're not going along with that. And so you have the newly elected pope, and you have the two other popes. So there were cartoons around Europe at this time of the three-headed monster. The papacy was depicted as a three-headed monster because of how ridiculous it was that here there were three popes. One in Avignon, the one that had been in Rome, actually headed off to a fortified city because he was afraid that he was going to have to fight for his papacy. And then there was a pope in Rome. Well, that was in 1409. The absurdity just continues to grow, obviously, with three popes. So in 1414, the Council of Constance was called. The emperor, he's just referred to as the emperor. He was the individual who would later be known as the Holy Roman Emperor, the emperor who ruled over the large parts of northern Europe, Germany and those areas. The Emperor Sigismund, called the Council of Constance in order to reunite the papacy. Well, one of the popes had actually taken refuge with Sigismund because he feared for his own life, and he agreed, Sigismund got him to agree that at the Council of Constance, he would be willing to step down if the other popes would be willing to step down. He, of course, thought that since he was on Sigismund's good side, he thought that he'd be the one who would be named pope. Well, when it became clear that he wasn't going to be, he took off, tried to hide. He was captured, I mean, literally captured. This is the how low the papacy has sunk by this point. He's captured as a fugitive, brought back to Constance, forced to step down, at which point the bishop or the pope who was in Rome at that time agreed to step down, and he did at that point. So you have one pope in Constance who steps down, the pope that's in Rome steps down, they elect a new pope. The pope who's in Avignon for the rest of his life still maintains that he's the pope, but nobody pays any attention to him. So at that point, the papacy with the Council of Constance is basically reunited when the two other popes are deposed. The third pope in Avignon is ignored. He'd become a bit of a laughingstock at that point. Now, at the same time, at the Council of Constance, there was an attempt to reform some of the morals, some of the theology that was going on, and we'll talk about that in a little bit because there are a couple of individuals that we're going to talk about now who were affected by what went on at the Council of Constance. Council of Constance is 1414. Now we're going to back up a little bit. We're going to go over to England. John Wycliffe lived from 1330 to 1384, so he died 30 years before the Council of Constance. He lived much of his life during the Babylonian captivity. The English church had always been a little bit of a maverick, had always been kind of independent. The English king always was a little bit independent. You can imagine during the Hundred Years' War, you've got the papacy in Avignon. Well, naturally, the king of England is going to want to distance himself and the church in England from the pope who was in Avignon during this time. So you have the church in England beginning to show some independence there. Wycliffe lived during this time. He was a theologian, a philosopher, spent much of his career teaching at Oxford. His focus, somewhat in contrast to the scholastic movement, we're going to talk, if we have time here, we're going to talk just a little bit about changes in the scholastic movement, but Wycliffe focused much more of his time on the study of the Bible. This is where you really see the seeds of the Reformation, where individuals are beginning to get the idea that simply following the teaching of the church and simply doing things the way the church had done things was not productive. And so you begin to have people going back to a greater focus on studying the scriptures. Wycliffe himself did not translate the Bible into English, but he liked the idea. And some of his followers, some of the people who lived soon after him, did translate the Bible into English. So imagine how striking that was. 150 years before the Reformation, the Bible is translated into the vernacular. The vernacular is simply a term that means the language that is common to whatever area you're living in. In English, obviously, the vernacular is English. He encouraged the translation of the Bible into English. And in so doing, and we'll see this in the Reformation, getting the scriptures into the hands of the people is an unbelievably powerful thing. When people begin to decide for themselves what the scriptures have to say, what the practice of the church is supposed to be, what the theology and the doctrine is supposed to be, that's an unbelievably powerful thing. And that's beginning to happen in England at this time. He also disputed the notion of the Eucharist. It was under Innocent III at the Fourth Lateran Council that the doctrine of the Eucharist was put in place. And this became a big issue in the Reformation. The doctrine of the Eucharist is that when the Mass is celebrated, the bread and the wine become the body and blood of Christ. There actually is a physical transformation, and they become the body and blood of Christ. Well, Wycliffe disputed this idea, and part of his dispute of this idea had to do with his thinking through, working through some of the Trinitarian issues that had gone on 1,100 years earlier, and just the whole question of, I mean, basically what he was saying is, if God was willing to become flesh, become man, then why would he do this magic trick of changing this bread and water into wine? And I mean, that was, in a nutshell, that was some of his reasoning behind his questioning of the Eucharist. Just thinking through, just exactly that, thinking through whether or not God would be engaged in magic tricks like that, or if he was content with the Eucharist, the bread and the wine, actually simply being more symbolic. Now, he didn't go all the way towards symbolism or anything like that, but he definitely questioned the church's teaching on the Eucharist. Well, all of these things made him unpopular with some of the leaders of the church in England, because he really was messing with things a little bit more than they wanted him to. The Bible in English and all that sort of thing. So he became unpopular. He was imprisoned at one point, but basically he died of a stroke. And if you look at the ages of these people on your sheet here, he died when he was 54 years old. You don't see very many people living to very ripe old ages at this point. He died a relatively peaceful death at home in 1384. John Huss lived from 1372 to 1415. He did not die a peaceful death. He lived in Bohemia. And initially, his reform was based more on the sorts of reforms that the conciliar movement were encouraging, reforming the morals of the church, getting back to celibacy, getting rid of simony. His reforms were pretty much the sort of reforms that anybody would sign on to within the church. But what happened is the teachings of Wycliffe found their way to Bohemia, to the university where he taught, and he did not initially embrace the teachings of Wycliffe, but a lot of his friends, a lot of his colleagues began to embrace some of Wycliffe's teachings, and he defended their right to embrace those teachings, as opposed to the church, which was basically at this point was saying, no, Wycliffe's teachings are heresy. And what ended up happening was the Pope at that time excommunicated all of the people in the university, the people in that area who were beginning to follow Wycliffe's teachings, excommunicated them because of Wycliffe's teachings. And at that point, John Huss said, when excommunication was pronounced and he was ordered not to teach and preach anymore, at that point he basically said that it was, he spent some time thinking it through, concluded it was more important for him to continue to preach what he thought was true than to submit to the excommunication of the Pope. And part of where he got into trouble was Pope John, and let me get the right pope for you here. Pope John the 22nd was needed to finance a crusade against the city of Naples. The city of Naples had gotten on his bad side, and so he needed to finance a crusade against the city of Naples and began to sell indulgences in order to finance the crusade, and Hus took a stand against the sale of indulgences. So again, you see some of the same things that come up later in the Reformation begin here at this time with folks like Wycliffe and Hus. Well, when he took a stand against the sale of indulgences, the Pope was very upset about that. Now we're up to the time of the Council of Constance, and John Hus is summoned to the Council of Constance in order to recant his position. He's summoned by Emperor Sigismund, who is his emperor. I mean, he's living in Sigismund's territories. And Sigismund promises him safe conduct, meaning you'll be safe on your way, you can say what you have to say, and then you'll be given safe passage back home again. Well, he gets to Constance, Hus believes him, he gets to Constance, and once he gets there, the safe conduct basically is taken away. He's asked to recant. He refuses to recant. He basically says to them, I'll recant if you can show me biblically where I'm wrong. I mean, show me where my positions are unbiblical, and I'll be happy to recant. No one stepped up to try to make a case biblically. He refused to recant. He's made a prisoner. And he ended up being burned at the stake. And he was burned at the stake, yes, somewhat for his views, but as much as anything else, because he refused to recant simply because the church told him to. He insisted on being convinced from Scripture of why he should recant, and when that didn't happen, he ended up being burnt at the stake. So the safe passage that he had been promised, when Sigismund figured, Hus doesn't have that many followers, that many supporters anyway, it's not going to be that big a deal. He ignores the fact that he'd offered him a safe conduct, and Hus is burned at the stake. Another decision that goes on at the Council of Constance at this point is they decided that Wycliffe was a heretic. So Wycliffe died 40 years earlier, 30 or whatever it was. He died quite a bit earlier. So once they decided Wycliffe was a heretic, they went to England, dug up his bones, burned them, and then scattered them. See, that was yeah. That'll teach him a lesson, huh? That was the common practice at that time, because, and we'll, again, when we talk about the Reformation a little bit, we'll talk about relics. In order to not have, if somebody was burned at the stake, they would take the ashes and they would scatter them across a body of water, basically so that there would be no trace, there would be nothing that they could hang on to venerate or to worship in any way. So, which did in fact happen, as we'll see with other relics. But John Hus is burned at the stake. Wycliffe's bones are burned at the stake, so to speak, and his ashes scattered. And with that, the Council of Constance takes their stand against the reforms that are going on. Well, and I'm going to wrap up. We didn't even come close to getting through this lecture, but basically, and this will be important when we get into the Reformation, when the council took that stand against John Hus, that created tremendous upheaval with the Bohemians. The Bohemians then became militant in their support of John Huss's teaching. And there was actually another one of John Huss's colleagues who went with him to Constance and was burned at the stake also. Well, when the Bohemians saw what they had done, they distanced themselves from the church. They had certain practices and certain teachings that were in contrast to what the church was teaching, and they held on to those practices, they held on to those teachings. And what happened was then Emperor Sigismund was told by the Pope that he needed to call a crusade against the Bohemians. The problem was they were messing with the wrong folks, because every time Sigismund brought an army against the Bohemians, they got thumped. The Bohemians, time and time again, would just had tremendous military victories against or over Emperor Sigismund and his forces. And so what finally happened, after they'd gotten tub-thumped several times, they finally decided to negotiate a settlement whereby the Bohemians were brought back within the church, but they were brought back with their own rules. They were allowed to do things a little bit differently than the rest of the church did. Again, paving the way for... Yeah, that's right. They got a discounted rate. But again, that paves the way for what we'll see with the Reformation in a little while. It's 9:00. Does anybody have any questions? If you need to go, feel free to go. But does anybody have any questions that you wanna ask about?
I just saw a documentary, I'm not sure what it was. I came into it late. Tyndale. Mm-hmm. And they credited him being the first person to really translate the Bible, New Testament, and part of the Old Testament into English.
They credited him wrongly if they did that. I mean, if it was a blanket, he was the first one to translate it into English. No, Wycliffe's followers did a lot of translation before Tyndale came along. Now, the Tyndale Bible during the time of the Reformation was a complete translation and was unbelievably influential for the English Reformation. And the whole idea of translating the Bible from Latin, which is the way they had it, but using the new, and we'll talk about this next week, using the Greek tools, the Hebrew tools that they had to translate the Bible into German, French, English. Yes, Tyndale did that during the period of the Reformation, but Wycliffe's followers began doing Bible translation before that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was talking specifically in English.
Wycliffe was in England. Wycliffe's followers translated much of the Bible into English. That's why we have the Wycliffe Bible translators. That's where the organization took its name.
Were they translated from Latin?
Well, largely, but not completely. It was during this time next week we'll talk about a return to some of the language studies during the Reformation and the beginning of recovery of the Greek New Testament, the Hebrew Old Testament. So they were beginning to do those things, but a lot of it was from Latin.
Well, what's interesting is, because I'm really confused now, because was Tyndale in the
1700s? No, he was in the 1500s. Wycliffe was in the 1300s.
But the whole focus of the movie was that how the powers were, I don't know if it was Catholic or whatever, but at the time of
Henry VIII. Yep. Yep.
It was literally illegal to translate the Bible into English, and they were actually, the church were killing believers who were trying to, you were burned at the stake if you had an English translation on your scripture.
You bet. You're getting about 4 weeks ahead of us here. But yes, that
sorry,
is very I true.
Won't be here, so. Yes. I just had this burning question. No,
yep.
Bad pun. I watched this the other night on TV, and it was astounding to me that the church was killing believers because they wanted to read the scripture.
Yep.
It just blew me away. I just couldn't even corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
That was, and all these people are just corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yep.
It's amazing how we take the end of our idols.
You bet, you bet.
I've got a pile of merits. Is there still a market?
I'll ask Jody if your merits are any good or not.
When Sigismund promised safe passage,
mm-hmm.
it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have any recourse, or he was just simply a...
He took a poll, so to speak. No, he wasn't a lackey of the Pope at all. He was, I mean, he was the one who had called the council, all that sort of thing. But basically, he stuck his finger in the wind to see if it was going to be a problem for him to rescind the safe passage, decided that it wasn't going to be a big problem. He was wrong, but he decided that Hus didn't have enough support. And in fact, the rest of the church assembled there wanted him burned at the stake. They wanted him condemned. So he made a poor decision that he could get away with rescinding the safe passage because he didn't think Hus had that much support.
I mean, he had no recourse against what the decision they made.
No, he was in support of it. He was fine with it.
Oh, so he was really a pure politician, kind of whatever.
Yeah, it didn't matter to him if Hus got burned at the stake there. Okay, anybody else? Are we done for the night? Thank you. Oops, I'll answer your question later. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.